Thank you. My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. And I am delighted to be here, and I would like to thank everyone who had anything to do with that decision very much for inviting us down here. I'm particularly glad to see Bill again and to renew that acquaintance. I'm glad to have the friends that I do in this room, and I'm delighted that Linda came down with me. We have a lot of fun together, and I like the idea of the theme of sober fun in 2001. If you're new, sober fun sounds a little I think the word is oxymoron, isn't it? Especially on Easter weekend. Because we know that in other parts of the country and in other cities in California and in Florida and all over the nation, Easter weekend is a time to really do some hooting and hollering. And we will be doing that too. We will be doing that here. This is a wonderful celebration. It's so interesting to me that Easter is probably the biggest celebration in all of Christendom. And what it celebrates is a resurrection. And a resurrection means brought back to life. And that's a miracle. And the fact that it happened to you and to me makes it no less a miracle. And so I'm glad to be with you today, this weekend, this Good Friday, to celebrate the resurrection that we are so clear about. And if you're new and are not really clear on that yet, I really am so glad you're here, because I have a hunch that by the time you leave here on Sunday, you will have heard some remarkable things. You will have seen some remarkable things. And that guy named Wilson that wrote that book said amazing things like, if what we have seen and felt and heard means anything at all, it means that each one of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, can form a relationship with a loving God as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. Now, if you're like me, you did not come here looking for a relationship with God. That didn't really inspire me. Those words are not quite what I had in mind. I knew about God from the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana. And he was mad, that guy, that he took us out to the Yellowstone River early one March when I was about 12 years old, and we were baptized. And that water was some 29 degrees Fahrenheit. And I didn't find God. I didn't find much anything for about 3 days, as I recall. They frightened little Clinty with that one, I'll tell you. Funny how those old ideas go in, boy, and they are really there for a while. They're absolutely there for a while. But stick around this weekend. Stick around, because you may not really be in touch with what you're looking for. You may not really be in touch with what the drinking was all about. A guy named Scott Peck, who's an author of all kinds of stuff, including a book called The Road Less Traveled and some others, made an interesting observation along the way. He said that for us, wine is cheap grace. And I hear that. Boy, I hear that. There's a bit of poetry on a wall in a nice recovery center that ends with two lines. Would anyone ever know that my life, with all its ruined hours, has been a search for Him? And so they've laid out a path here for us. Not a path that I had my last drink on 14th of August 1966, and I was astonished when I woke up to the fact that I hadn't had a drink. And it was 9 months after I got sober that I was aware. I went, wow, that's, man. I'm kind of like Silkworth in a way, you know, in the book. He wrote The Doctor's Opinion, and basically what he says is, you guys need something that medical science cannot provide. And people went back to him. He worked in the hospital, worked with alcoholics, and reported, I haven't had a drink in 8 months. And he said, wow. And that's the medical contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous. We must have driven him crazy. Can you imagine? He described us as restless, irritable, and discontent when we weren't drinking. And I love those words. We told him that about ourselves. And if you're new, that'll sound like strange language to you. It'll sound like the understatement of the year. We have just decided to move to Australia, and we go in, and he says, how you doing? A little restless today. Just decided to kill my wife. How are you doing? Oh, irritable. I'm going on another geographic, and I won't be back. How you feeling? Discontent, sis? You know, that wonderful understatement, like that story of Jim in the Big Book. He's so great, this guy. He's working at a car dealership because he used to own it, but he lost it because he's a drunk, and he's in there. And he says interesting stuff. I was mildly irritated that I had to work for him. I love Jim. He's just great. Had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Jim, words with the boss are always serious. Decided to take a drive out in the country where I might find a prospect for a new car. That's where they are, Jim, lining those country roads, waiting for you. And so, that's the thinking. This book called Alcoholics Anonymous describes me as having a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. Insanity, they call that. And I had no idea, none. I'm just bumping along. I'm just having another drink. I'm in 1966, 29 years old, living in what I then called a garage, a double garage. Four of us lived in there in these little rooms. Little smelly, nasty rooms with sticky linoleum floor and a steel cot and a wet mattress on it and a weird stuff going. I had a little radio, a clock radio. And that clock radio would every once in a while start to play. Just music mostly. Unplug it, it still plays. To take it out and put it in the dirt outside the door. It's playing. That baby is playing. Weird, weird radio. And I had some visitors in that room. one morning at 4, I woke up, the clock said 4, and I came to, and there's a rat over in the corner, and I'm on the floor under the cot, and the rat and I are kind of lined up. He looked fierce. Man, he looked fierce. And I'm afraid to get up on the cot, you know, because he might rush me and... We know how that'll end. I look at that rat, and he's looking at me, and I hunker down for an hour, and now the clock says 4:07, you know, it's on the hour. Finally, the first light of day. Enough light to look over there in the corner again, and the strangest thing that happened, that rat had turned into a pair of socks laying over there. So, if you're new here, and you, if you have one of those radios, I didn't even get it about the radio. I have a friend, a lady that Gail was arrested once for taking a hammer and beating a parking meter. Somebody asked her why she was beating, and it turned out the parking meter was broadcasting every rotten thing that she had ever done. And that's the information I needed to know about the radio. One of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that our blind spots are not in the same location for all of us. And I could hear about that parking meter. And only then did I get it about the radio. So, if you have one of those radios, or if you've been held hostage by a pair of socks all night, welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm so glad you're here, and so is everybody else. And so I'm walking along the sidewalk. I thought it was a garage. That disillusioned and insane Linda and I were over in that area not that long ago, maybe 5 years ago. And she said, I want to see the garage. And I said, okay. And we drove down in that area. And she said, is that it? And I said, yeah. She said, that's not a garage. That's a shed is what that is. And I looked again, and by God, no car had ever gotten in that place. And it was a shed. It was just a shed with four little rooms in it. I couldn't have recognized the other three guys. I could hear them. They had a little shower someplace out there, which was an unconfirmed rumor to me. I never went out there. But some days I got back to the shed, and some nights I didn't. Some nights I'd go to jail. Some nights I'd be in the park. But always, always, the awakening in that shed was worse than being in the park, and it was worse than being in jail. Because there's that odd need for a drink. When you're in jail, you wake up in jail, and when you know where you are, you don't need a drink quite as bad as you did, because you know it's not going to happen. But in the shed, you know, just get going, get going. And I'm walking down the street one day, and I didn't plan to live there. You know, I was not really... I just wound up there. The car was gone, and the family and the kids, and it was all gone. It was all gone. And I was beginning to get the notion that it was not coming back. And I had mixed emotions about that. I didn't want my kids to see me. I certainly didn't want my commander in the Marine Corps to see me. I certainly didn't want the people that I had known at the dental school at the University of Oregon to see me. I certainly did not want the people that I had known in college. I didn't want the mothers of those children to see me, or the ministers, or the psychiatrists, or all the people that gave me opportunity, that gave me surcease when they could. I didn't want to be seen by those people. My mailing address was General Delivery Glendale, and I didn't go by there. And I don't know why I had the idea there was an agent there waiting for me to pick up my mail, some FBI guy, something. I don't know if I was not. But I knew it was unsafe. No place was safe. No place was safe. And I'm just hanging on, living there. And I know that Skid Row is 3 weeks away. And I'm dying. And I have quit drinking a lot. A lot. Once for 6 weeks. The first time I quit drinking was 6 weeks. And then I'm drunk again. And then it was every day, twice, three times a day in the morning. This is the last half pint I'm going to need. And that was all over. And I had not admitted to myself that I cannot quit. But the fight was going out of me. And the life had gone out of me. And my hope was gone. And I'm walking down the sidewalk in Glendale one day, and a guy pulls up and honks, and I look over and he calls my name, and I walk to the car. His name is Don Armstrong, a bail bondsman in Glendale. And we had done some business together. And he said, "I'm going to take you someplace." And he brought me to you. That day he put me in his car, and at noon we're on Maryland Avenue at something called the Alano Club of Glendale, whatever that may be, up above a laundry. And I sat there with you, and I was there for 3 weeks, going to meetings, sitting there every day. It seemed safe to me there, and I stayed. And then I had some bad luck. I ran across some cash and some amphetamines on the same day. That calls for a drink. In fact, my friend Ed and I celebrate the commonality of our bail bondsmen when we meet. They didn't have recovery programs. They had a place out in the valley run by a guy named Ron Shire, and they called it Shire's Dryer. A little spin dry deal out there, and so I'm drunk again, and I'm bad drunk. I was drunk for 2 weeks, and I woke up in the shed one more time, and I'm on my way over to I don't know where, but my footsteps led me to the Alano Club. And up a long flight of steps hung on the side of that building, and the door was open. It's mid-morning, and the door's open. Somebody is doing his job in AA. Some guy that recognized me from some of the meetings. And he asked me how I was doing, and I said, "I'm not doing good." He said, "What happened?" I said, "I got drunk and let everybody down." "Oh," he said, "are you alcoholic?" "I really don't know the answer, you know. I don't know. But I need this guy, and he's being nice to me." And so I finally said, "Yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now." Which means, basically, I'm a mild case. And under that, the message is, I won't be any trouble. I needed him. I needed to be there that day. Not because I thought I'd find an answer there, but because I didn't want to be on the streets. I didn't want to be in the shed. I didn't want to be in jail or in the park. And so I tried to buy my way in by letting him know I'm a mild case. He brightened. He was just wonderful. He said, "Well, if you say you're an alcoholic and you got drunk?" Yeah. He's moved right through that mild case thing, and he's... I said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "Well, you know what? You didn't let us down. He didn't surprise us. If you want to surprise us, you should get a job. That'd surprise us. They were harsh in Glendale in 1964. And he added something interesting. He said, if you're alcoholic, he said, the reason it didn't surprise us that you got drunk, if you're alcoholic, you will drink no matter what. I could not have said that. I have never said that. He said that. And I went, oh. All of a sudden I had an awareness of knowing that. I drink no matter what. I'll tell you, I'm going to come home right after I drink. I'll stop and pick up the kids. No, I drink. I'll bring the check home. No, I drink. I'll be out there on the flight line at 05. No, I drink. I drink. I drink. And I drink no matter what. There is something about that information that is liberating in a weird way. There is something about that information that is freeing because it's the truth of it. There was a time that I thought I could quit. And when I think I can quit, then it's up to me to do that. And that is a hideous fight. That is such a hideous fight. He didn't talk to me about quitting. He didn't talk to me about tomorrow. He just said, stay here today. Just stay here. And now he and I both know that I will drink no matter what. That's the way that it is. And I never drank after that. 34 years, I never drank. I've been angry enough to drink. I've been crazy enough to drink. I've been humiliated enough to drink. I've been bold enough. I've been gloating enough to drink. I never drank. Somewhere in chapter 8 of this book of ours, it says God's either solved our drinking problem or he has not. I think that's what it takes. And there isn't anywhere in this literature that I've ever seen that says you must quit. Isn't that interesting? And we don't talk like that, really. I've been thinking a lot about Chuck C., who many of us knew. Powerful, powerful figure of a guy. And you know what he said about his last drink? He said, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had two. Wilson says, he didn't say I quit. He says, there at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Judy got up here and read the steps. There's 12 of them. You'd think if it was about quitting, they would tell you that. They'd say, step one, quit! Quit! Your mother and I are worried sick about you. Just stop. It doesn't say that. It says, in effect, step one, you got to get that you are toast. Powerless, unmanageable. Those words we long to hear, right? That takes a little getting used to, doesn't it? And I got it that day, and I didn't know I got it that day. He said, you're going to drink no matter what. Okay. Got it. Got it. the battle was over and I had lost that battle, and it was just hang on, stay here, don't go anywhere. I didn't hear anything about AA that day that I can remember. I don't recall saying any prayer that liberated me. Some people remember their prayer. I don't remember a prayer. And sometimes our prayers are a little hard to spot as prayers, you know. God, I love to think about Gail and how one day when I was a year and a half sober, she's at Wilshire in Normandy in Los Angeles, talking about the alcoholic's prayer. Looking so, she died sober since then, but she was a powerful figure of a woman. Attractive in all the ways that AA women are attractive. Poised and grateful. And she talked about the alcoholic's prayer. The backdrop of this story was that she lived in a place in a Hollywood apartment and came out of a blackout sitting on the mantel over the fireplace in the living room. Yeah. Oh, I'm liking this, Gail, you know. My kind of girl. She wouldn't put me down for drinking, not this one. She'd understand. The reason she's on the mantel with her cat, her cat's up there, and there's a little cat food and vodka up there, a little something for everybody, you know. And that was because there was 4 inches of water on the floor. Yeah. And the reason for that was she had started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal got away from her somehow. You know. Oh, now I'm thinking, Gail, we got to go to dinner. I really would like to get to dinner. And then she tells the alcoholic prayer, and it's why I remember the story. Her prayer, Jesus, God, what's wrong with me? Yeah. A little too profane to be a prayer. It's a prayer. It is a prayer. It is a prayer that separates the religion out of what we really need so we can hear it and say it in some way. Somebody provided some information out of World War II, an amphibious landing in Anzio. Freedom of Information Act made documents available, and they pulled a these guys, it was a terrible mess of an amphibious invasion by the Allied troops. Well-manned machine guns, 300 yards inland on a tree line. Cut down those Allied troops as they came off those landing craft. And they stacked up at the beach. The guys would crawl into them again. It took them 4 days to secure that beach. And a lot of guys died. But not right away. They hide behind the piles of bodies of those that have died. And so those men would find a paper somewhere and a pencil and try to write a letter home, a poem, a prayer, one guy's prayer. God, come. Come now. Come yourself. Don't send your son. This is no place for children. Yes. Yes. And I don't know my prayer, but that prayer resonated with me. Because if somebody said, one time somebody said, I just, it seemed to me I went right to headquarters. All the mail gets delivered there. And so I don't know my prayer. But I know that an interesting change happened to me on the 14th of August, 1966. Because on the 15th, I didn't drink. And I used to despair. You know, I'd read this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and Wilson had that white light experience in a, oh, how nice for you, Bill. You know. because there was something in me that didn't feel like it was getting fed. He'd say things like, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And one day we begin to awaken. And I noticed something interesting. His impact on me had been sudden. I mean, on the 14th of August, I'm a drunk. And on the 15th of August, I'm not a drunk. And that is sudden, isn't it? I mean, that is moving right along. And I didn't do that. And he didn't mull it over. It's just like, yes, yeah, got it. That was profound, because whatever happened that day was not of my doing. And I don't recall asking for it. I think I knew I was way too far beyond the pale to get any kind of help. But it was profound, because it went right to that little piece in me that always has to have a drink. And it healed that piece. And the obsession was taken. And these last 34 years have been about learning how to live comfortably without a drink. And that seems to be what these steps are about. And of course, at first, it was interesting. I was 9 months sober, and I was allowed to see my youngest son for the first time in a long time. And we're standing at the water in Santa Monica, and I heard him say, my four-year-old, why are you crying, Daddy? What are you crying about? And I didn't know I was crying. I had counted back and astonished to discover that 9 months had gone by. I hadn't had a drink in 9 months. Hadn't wanted one in most of that time. And it brought tears to my eyes. And I don't know what I said to him. He's since been at a few meetings of AA. He since knows all about this miracle in my life. He and his wife and his three children. But that was the day I figured it out. My driver's license had come back to me. I had a job. I'd been taken to the nut house at Metropolitan State Hospital to help them put on me. I thought they were going to leave me there. I thought this is how you did it in AA. I slept in my own little bed that night. And I had had amazing experiences already in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I knew that there had been a profound change. And I knew for a moment or two that that's a miracle, that a resurrection is in there someplace. And then I forgot that, like we do. I missed the miracles after that because I took credit for them. But I'm busy in AA, and I'm in meetings, and I'm eventually sponsoring people, and I've had a sponsor for most of that time, and a home group, and all this stuff. And I've loved it here. I have loved it here. I heard a guy from the East Coast named Ray who said that when he was 5 years old, sober, his sponsor told him, he said, Ray, there's something else the matter with you. And we all have a kind of a sneaky hunch that that might be the case. You know, because we see a guy take a cake at 5 years of sobriety and he's got problems. And I know, at 5 years, I'm going to be past that. No, he's slow. And then I get to 5 years and it's, wow, that guy was doing pretty good. The guy asked me a very interesting question. You see, I wasn't fully enrolled in the solution here. Oh, I love it, and I love AA, I love it. I love the fellowship, I love the service. There's such relief out of that. There's such wonderful relief out of unity and being in a room with people and having this marvelous kind of an experience, and yet... And yet, I have my moments. I have tasted the honey. And then it's gone. It's interesting in the book, Bill says that he had an interesting experience at Winchester Cathedral. And then his attention is taken by the tombstone with the doggerel on it. But there is a little sentence in there that's interesting. He says, "Much moved, I wandered outside." And you wouldn't give it any attention at all. You wonder even why he put it in there. Because he writes tight. And there doesn't seem to be anything in there that doesn't have a purpose. And then you read the rest of his story a little more carefully, maybe after the 100th time or so, and thought that at page 13 he says, "I finally realized the significance of that moment at Winchester Cathedral so long ago." He'd been thinking about it. He had never thought about it. He had never forgotten that moment. "Much moved, I wandered outside." And maybe 15 years go by, and he's 34, and he's in town hospital, and he's sober, and the significance of that moment, he says, is, "For a brief moment I had needed and wanted God, and was humbly willing to have him with me, and he came." And I've sat in meetings, and you have too, where we knew that we were in exactly the right place. There wasn't any objection to any of it. And I didn't know what that meant. All I knew is I had tasted the honey. And it was very sweet. And it never lasted. I've sat in meetings with you. And I've known beyond any doubt that my sobriety is a miracle. And then that moment is gone. And as Wilson says, it was a brief moment, and replaced by those awful thoughts and worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And you leave the meeting and you get in the car, and on the way home somebody cuts you off, and it's all over. And I'm living from a different part of my mind now. My ego is up, and we're doing all of that. But we don't forget those moments. And we wonder what they mean and when they're going to come again. And they seem to be hit and miss. And when will I finally have the peace that I sought all the time? And of course, that time does not seem to arrive. Maybe in the 35th year, I'll let you know. But there are wonderful, wonderful experiences available here. A guy along the way. Because I'm a seeker. I am a seeker. A seeker is somebody that's been touched by God in such a way that nothing less will ever do. And there was a reason I drank, and perhaps a reason you drank. I wanted peace of mind. I wanted to have all my parts walking around in the same set of shoes. I wanted integrity. I loved the Marine Corps for that reason. By God, everybody was in lockstep. And we all got it. And we didn't have that horrible notion that other people were getting information that we weren't getting. You know, they told you. It's like AA. They tell you. There are no secrets here about what you should do and what the program is all about. And so I had a little trouble getting... I knew my life was unmanageable, but I really didn't understand why or what could be done about it. And the day came. That I was given a wonderful opportunity to get back into the steps. Oh, I'd done an inventory, and I had written a four-step and read it, and I had paid the money back, and I was financially clean with the people that were in my life and had been in my life. I'd gone to law school when I was 5 years sober, and I'm practicing law, and I'm enjoying that, and it's all fine, except something's missing. I had a great, we were talking about it tonight, a house that I thought would make me happy. All the stuff that I thought knew would make me happy was in my life, and it wasn't working. And then I went through a period of time when all that stuff left. And that didn't work any better. In fact, that scares you, you know. But out of that, I wound up in a meeting in Little Rock. Met some people that are amazing people because they knew about this book and about these steps. And I got enrolled in the solution. And it was absolutely amazing. To be actually, you know, it's when they told me, they said, Clint, your approach to these steps is interesting. You're like a guy that would like to have a chocolate cake, and you go down and buy a box of cake mix, and you read the directions on the side, and you say, now where's my cake? And you don't get any cake from reading the directions. And so you get a group together, and you read it in unison. That had a familiar ring to it. I let's get it translated into French, and you know. So you got to do it. Follow those directions. And I became kind of a lab rat. I decided that I was, you know, mad, of course. The road had changed, and I hadn't noticed. I'm stumbling around in a plowed field out there someplace, objecting to everything, but I'm desperate. I'm absolutely desperate, and these guys had something. And so I decided to take the huge chance of assuming that everything that is in the book is applicable to me, not when I'm new, but right now. Everything in the book is true, that those guys did what they said they did, and they got the results that they claimed they got. And I was, by God, going to find out if that would happen to me, because I would do the ultimate experiment. I would do exactly what they said they did to see if I got the results. And if I didn't get the results, well, then we can go play golf. You know, it's like, we don't need to be doing this anymore. And so I started along the way, I was challenging this business of sanity. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, step two. And this guy tried to get it across to me, but I'm evaluating my mind with my mind, you know. We got the hound dogs watching the stakes here, and he said, well, let's do it another way. He said, write down the 20 craziest things you ever did. So I went back to him in a week or two with my list. And on that list is some crazy stuff. Your list and my list has crazy stuff in it. First time I went to jail, arrested off of the fire escape of the sorority house at the University of Oregon at midnight. And it seemed like, it sounds crazy, but let me explain why I was there. I'd been drinking in a off-campus beer bar that night, and a pretty girl was there, and she almost looked at me, so I thought we had something. And I looked around again, and she was gone. I found out where she lived, and I'm going up the fire escape of the Tri-Delta house at midnight to discuss our future. And and a couple of years later, I'm at the dental school at the University of Oregon. I had no business being there, but I was a student there. With some awkward moments attached to that, because we had a clinic on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. The clinic meant there's somebody sitting in a chair, and I'm supposed to be doing something. And I get drunk on Friday night. On Saturday morning, I get up and drop a couple of amphetamines, which gives you a pretty good tremor, and they had just come out with that high-speed air-driven handpiece, and you can take out a quadrant of teeth just twitching, you know. I made a set of dentures for a guy the first year I was up there. He came up the second year bringing his wife, somebody was doing something, and he'd see me at the end of the clinic. On Saturday morning, he'd go, "Say." Uh-huh. something wrong with my teeth. There was a, we all need a guy that looks like he's a worse drunk. You know what I mean? You need that. If I ever get as bad as that guy in the next cell, I'm going to, I'd be at a party and I would have bitten the hostess on the hip, but this guy had high-centered his car in the rock garden and I'm just like, so glad he's there. Because the eclipse effect is what I need to disguise my own pathology. And there was a senior at the dental school when I was a sophomore that was that person for me, because he one Saturday morning was supposed to give a guy a shot and he stuck that needle up there and tried to catch a branch of that facial nerve, and your the technique was to kind of massage it and guide that needle, and he did that and he was pretty sick. He went in the back, had a cigarette, threw up, came back out again and said, "Is your face numb?" And the guy said no, and he went back and came out again, and he noticed now the guy had a little trickle of blood coming down the side of his face, and he noticed that his left hand was numb. And I'm going, yes! Insane, just insane. So I wrote all that. Now, they threw me out of dental school, a source of comfort to many people in Portland that year. I drank on Skid Row for a while, waiting to go in the Marine Corps. I'd been getting student deferment. Skid Row drinking is not bad. They really, I liked it. I liked it. They don't ask goofy questions like, how are you? You know, it doesn't come up. Came out of a blackout around a little scarred up wooden table across from some woman that it felt like we were together, you know what I mean? And traveling, because she's got her things with her. I didn't know where, in brown paper bags, I didn't know where we'd met or what our relationship was. I didn't know her name. I didn't know. I would have asked her, but she was sleeping, and I didn't. She had a little chili on her cheek, so I knew we'd had dinner together. There's a line in one of the stories in the back, and I hope they leave this story in the fourth edition. The line is, somehow I got out of there. And it kind of became my... And I did. I put that on my list. I put the trouble in the Marine Corps. I love the Marine Corps. Quantico through OCS, and then Fort Sill for artillery school with the Army, and then Camp Pendleton and El Toro, and I had good jobs in the military. But one day... a commander said, "There isn't any room in the Marine Corps for an alcoholic, Lieutenant." Oh, that's hard to hear. Stay out of the staff club, Lieutenant. Because I would go where the staff NCOs were, because they really were reluctant to order an officer to do anything. But they must have hated to see me coming. An unwelcome hanger-on, to be sure. I put all that down. Letters of reprimand, a board of inquiry. I can't pack the gear. And I loved it. And I was heartbroken that I could not be one of those men. Drinking out of the hot vodka bottles in the orange groves north of the base. Unable to be effective at all. Lost the job at the NCO leadership school where I was an instructor. And finally, about three steps ahead of a general discharge, my tour of duty was over and I got an honorable, and I moved to Glendale, and I lived in an apartment for a while, and then in the car, and then in the ship. And so I wrote these things. I wrote down the last time I got arrested for drunk driving. I was in Glendale at 10 in the morning on my way from a beer bar where they had been serving me near beer. Can you believe that? Isn't that a frightening moment when the beer doesn't work? On to get a drink. The light was red. I stopped. The light turned green and amber and red and green. I was resting. Then a cop was there, and the rest of it is a little tedious, except the report. He wrote on his report, I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself. There's a life with power in it, isn't there? People you've never met before come up and say things like, you're under arrest. I want a jury trial. I always ask for a jury trial. And I learned a lot. And I wrote that down, and I went back to the guy with my list, and he said, that's a lot of booze in that list. I said, yeah, a lot of evidence you should never drink. I said, I know. I know. He said, you didn't write the craziest thing down you ever did. I said, what is that? He said, and you did it a lot. And you did it before you drank. I said, what is that? He said, with all this evidence, you would get that you should never drink at all. And failing to remember the horror of the last drunk, but while you were still sober, and before you started to drink again, you did the most insane thing that you can do. And I said, what? He said, you decided to take another drink. You decided that a drink would be a good idea. That's crazy. That's insane. And you brought that mind into Alcoholics Anonymous with you. Now, can we do step two? I mean, it's just amazing when we begin to wake up and get a glimpse of it, that we're only here in this remarkable fellowship could we be useful. And everything I had done, a lot of what I had done in my sobriety was all about trying to outrun the problem. But those steps are so glorious. And they're all about power and lack of power. And that the day came when I found a place inside me where I can go where God is. I thought I would never find that. At the end of chapter four, it says, when we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. And I would say, disclose yourself. And I really desperately needed him and needed some evidence. And he was there. I was down here in San Diego. At a hotel, trying a lawsuit, one morning in a hotel room, looking at that book. And when I walked across the street to do my part of the trial, I was different. And I knew I was different, and I've known it since then, because I'm not alone. Because finally I was connected to the divinity in the universe. And that's so amazing. Finally, a relationship with a power greater than myself did not seem a bad idea. And I since learned that there is a relationship seems like a bad idea, but I've never been in a relationship. You know, I didn't know the difference between an arrangement and a relationship. We come and say, I'm having trouble with my relationship. You don't have a relationship. That's an arrangement, pal. That's a contractual thing. The point of it is so everybody can keep score. Wow. That's been such a wonderful thing for Linda and me to have a relationship. To have, there's a covenant to it, not a contract. There's sacred ground there. It's reflective of my relationship with God. And the point isn't to be right. The point is to be happy. There's, different kinds of prayer come up. There's three kinds that we know about. One is, help me. We've all said that. Another one is give me good kind of prayer, good prayer. Grant me the strength. Is there any prayer to give me prayer? And then finally, use me. Use me. We begin to get a sense of whose we are, not who. I thought it was about who I am. It's about whose I am. And there's a place in me that belongs only to you, a place in me that belongs only to Linda, a place in me that belongs to God. And there's a little piece in me that's never going to get it. And I have to have a little compassion for that piece, too. But this is a good place to have compassion for parts of us that are never going to get it. This is such a wonderful thing. And to read that inventory, it's all about, what am I afraid of? That fear inventory is about, I'm afraid of power. People look more powerful. Even a guy on the street in L.A. that comes up and asks me for a buck at that moment has the power to make me feel silly. And I put him on my list. I'm like, what's the resentment inventory? What do I resent? I resent power. The sex inventory. It's about power. It's about my attempt to extract power from something that is not a legitimate source of power. Oh, I'm so glad they asked me if God is everything or nothing, and I couldn't answer the question. And they said, list the five things that you're not willing to give up for a better relationship with God. Oh, wow, that's interesting, because it shows me where I'm trying to get power. And that gets resolved. And you say, finally, there's nothing more important to me. I've been in the desert for so long. I've been in the far country. Sober, yeah. And I didn't do that. And I need peace. I need to be useful. I need to be home. And that fifth step is just part of the deal. And six and seven is more of the same. There's an interesting thing that seventh step said, humbly asking to remove our shortcomings. And as I was going through that, I was up north in Northern California, and a lady gave a talk that knocked me out. She was 20 years sober from Reno. And when she reported a time when she was 10 years sober, she wanted to get over her fear of heights. And she decided to take skydiving lessons. And she did. And the day came, she's supposed to solo out of an airplane. And it comes over the drop zone at whatever, 3,500 feet, not that high, but she has pulled her. And the parachute was wrong. She had packed it herself, but it didn't open right. And she hit the ground. She's telling the story about hitting the ground a lot faster than she was supposed to. And she said she spent the next 18 months of her life at 10 years of sobriety in a hospital learning how to urinate again. So you kind of got that, wow, that's a... And I'm listening to this. And her husband left, but her ex-husband came, who was an AA, came back into her life as a friend. And they're talking one day in the rehab facility. And he finally said, I just need to know, what was that all about? She said that... Yeah, he said, why'd you do that? What was that about? She said, I was just trying to get over my fear of heights. And he started to laugh, which annoyed her. And she said, what are you laughing about? And he said, all you had to do was humbly ask. I went, ooh. Ooh. Oh, I've been jumping out of airplanes all my life. Working so hard at problems that are not really problems. Our problems only because I'm working at it. Man. Isn't that sweet? The synchronicity of it is wonderful. I mean, I'm struggling with steps. So I get something very powerful from it. I get launched into 8 and 9, and I flew back to Roanoke where my dad is buried and knelt at that grave, and I flew to Denver with my sister and sat down with her and her husband and their kids, and flew to Portland where my brother is, and I flew to Atlanta where my younger brother is. He since died a couple of years ago. Not an alcoholic, but the nature of our household was such that we all took our hits, and he was so angry that he died pushing a cart with his worldly possessions in Atlanta. Angry. He needed to show the world how badly treated he had been. wouldn't come out here to be with us. I sat with my sons. There are three of them. I sat with their mothers. There are two. And I launched into something that has been most gratifying to me, and that is taking other guys through the steps the way those guys took me. The law practice came back. All of that is fine. But some of the sweetest moments of my week are the moments on Saturday morning when I got somebody there and we're doing these steps. And I watch them launch out into those amends. God, they're spectacular. God, it's just amazing. Alan went to many places there where he said, I remodeled your home, but I did a bad job and I came here to straighten it out. What can I do to make it right? And they will tell you. And Tom was a fascinating guy. Still carries a bullet in his body. Right tonight, he's producing news stories for NBC. He's in public relations. He's supposed to be in lockdown, and he's in public relations. But we all conducted the experience, an experiment, and pushed the envelope. And he's out there. He was a window washer and a burglar. Yeah, a nice dovetailing of careers, I thought. You know where to go back at night. And he had 13 places in South Pasadena to call on. And he did that. He did that. Hi. Did you live here 5 years ago when your home was burglarized? I did that. And I came here to straighten that out with you. He could have gone to jail at every one of those. There was one, he went by and they weren't home, and then he went by another time and he couldn't get out of his truck. He just didn't have the power, and I'll tell you, you have to be tapped into power, real power by then, to do that. And he called me one morning, he said, I got one more to make and I'm going to go by today, and I knew about this one. I said, you want me to come with you? He said, no. I said, call me when you're done. He called me that morning at 11 o'clock and he said, I'm done. And I could hear it in his voice. He was free. I knew he was free. I said, what happened? He said, it was an older couple. And I talked to them for a while, and they invited me in. And they had a lot of questions to ask. They wanted to know what I had done and why the mirror off that wall. And told them there, I thought it was safe was behind it, and this and that. And he said, and as we talked, they seemed to relax, and we talked a little more, and then the cookies came out. And at the end, the question is, what can I do to make this right? And they said, we're even. And he said, I don't know how you can say that. And they said, yeah, we can say that. Because until you got here this morning, we always thought our son had done that. And it's like, we're tapped into real power here. Yeah. A family healed. Tom got free. I watched a miracle. And you know that there is such a remarkable spiritual component to this idea of anonymity, because we're really here not to love one another, but to live our lives in such a way that God can love someone through us. And God was loving those people through Tom that day. And God had loved Tom through me. And God has loved me through the guys that took, and all of you. And if you're new here tonight, it's AA. It's weird. It's weird. You'll hear weird stuff here. I sat in a meeting one night and heard a lady say, your problems will die of neglect. I want a funeral, you know. I want to be busy with it. I heard a lady say down in Texas, she said her sponsor told her, if it's going to be funny someday, it's probably funny today. The weirdest thing of all, there's power here, and the power is love, and we love you. We're willing to live our lives in such a way, really, that God can love you through us. I'm willing tonight to live my life in such a way that God can love Linda through me. I'm willing tonight to live my life in such a way that God can love you through me. And you know what? That's the sweet way to live. because I get all the love I need. I'm the water hose, but I get all the water I need. And on it goes. For 65 years and a little bit, we've been calling that Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad I'm here. Thank you.
You've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.